I want to talk to you real quickly about a Bible that I am enjoying so much. It's a Bible edited by a single adult by LaGarde Smith. I have degrees in religion. My doctoral degree is in religion. But I have never enjoyed reading the Bible as much as I've enjoyed reading what's called the narrated Bible. This Bible is written in chronological order. The Bibles most of you read are not written. They're written in canon order. So that things are not necessarily in the historical time period. Some of Isaiah happened in a little bit different time sequences than it's in the book of Isaiah. That's not saying it isn't the Word of God. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying that the time sequence, you have to understand it. Let me give you a really good example. First and Second Samuel are my favorite books of the Bible. Well, sometimes you're reading all that, and you know, some of the Psalms were written by David, but you got to skip over to the book of Psalms to read them. And what they have done in this Bible is the Psalm is right in the text, right where it was written. So you're reading along, all of a sudden you read the Psalm and you'd be stunned. For example, the sin of David and Bathsheba. Right there in that sin, then you read the 51st Psalm, create in me a clean heart, O God, renew a right spirit within me. You know how you get bogged down with so-and-so beget so-and-so, Barak, Arara, Rubu, you know? Those are only in here one time. And there's anything that's repeated in Scripture is listed. All the repetitions is at the same point. Levitical law, that's very hard to understand. Deuteronomy and Numbers and Leviticus. Very difficult to understand that. Those are all combined and the entire Bible is outlined. The thing I really also like about it is it has little sunrises and sunsets in it. You can't see this, but it tells you how much you're supposed to read that day. And it's balanced out, so you just read. If you're reading in the morning, you read to the next sunrise. Or if you're reading at night, you read to the sunset. And also, the neat thing about the last part of it, the Apostle Paul's writing is written in the order of his missionary journeys. Now, I admit it's an expensive Bible. I think it's about $29. They're just coming out. As more of them get out on the market, they will be cheaper. One last thing you need to know about it. It's difficult. A lot of single adults don't like to read the Old Testament, because they don't understand the Old Testament. I love the Old Testament. And what they do in here, they have what we call annotated notes. And here's an example, if I can find one. When you want one, they're not here. That explains what the passage is in red, or wine color, to tell you what that passage is going to be about. Let me give an example. There are times in the Old Testament where God says, kill everyone. Don't leave anyone alive. Now that sounds awful to us. What kind of God? You give a Bible to a non-convert, and he reads that, or a new convert, and goes, I want to serve a God who kills everybody. But the text explains that that was the military strategy of that day. It's not anything new at all, but that was the military strategy of that day. And it just helps make the Bible come alive. I guarantee you'll read more of the Bible, the narrated Bible by Harvest House, edited by F. LaGarde Smith. And you can tell why he's single. If your name was LaGarde, you'd probably be single too. I want to read a children's story to you, Frog and Toad. And yes, my mic is it on up there? It's on. I'm sorry. Is he coming back? Yeah. Okay. And so they'll adjust it, and we'll just have to hang with it until he gets back.
I'll try to speak loudly.
Okay. I want to read Toad and Frog, and it's called A List. One morning, Toad sat up in bed. Oh, I have many things to do, he said. I'll write them all down on a list so that I can remember them. So Toad wrote on a piece of paper, a list of things to do today. Then he wrote, wake up. Well, I've already done that, said Toad. So he crossed out, wake up. Toad wrote all the things he had to do on the paper. Eat breakfast, get dressed, go to Frog's house, take a walk with Frog, eat lunch, take a nap, play games with Frog, eat supper, go to sleep. There, said Toad, now my entire day is all written down. He got out of bed and had something to eat. So he crossed out, eat breakfast. Toad took his clothes out of the closet and put them on. So he crossed out, get dressed. Toad put the list in his pocket. He opened the door and walked out into the morning. Soon Toad was at Frog's front door. He took the list from his pocket and crossed out, go to Frog's house. Toad knocked at the door. Hello, said Frog. Look at my list of things to do, said Toad. Oh, said Frog, this list is very nice. Toad says, my list tells me that we will go for a walk. All right, said Frog, I'm ready. Frog and Toad went on a long walk. Then Toad took the list from his pocket again. He crossed out, "Take walk with frog." Just then, there was a terrific wind. It blew the list right out of Toad's hand. The list blew high up into the air. "Help," cried Toad, "my list is blown away. What will I do without my list?" "Hurry," said Frog. "We'll run and catch it." "No," shouted Toad, "I cannot do that." "Why not?" said Frog. "Because," wailed Toad, "running after my list is not one of the things that I wrote on my list of things to do today." So Frog ran after the list. He ran over hills and swamps, but the list blew on and on. At last Frog came back to Toad. "I'm sorry," gasped Frog, "but I could not catch your list." "That," said Toad, "I cannot remember any of the things that are on my list of things to do. So I'll just have to sit here and do nothing," said Toad. So Toad sat and did nothing, and Frog sat with him doing nothing. After a long time, Frog said, "Toad, it's getting dark. We should be going to sleep now." "Go to sleep," shouted Toad. "That was the last thing on my list." So Toad wrote on the ground with a stick, "Go to sleep." Then he crossed out, "Go to sleep." "There," said Toad, "now my day is all crossed out." "I'm glad," said Frog. Then Frog and Toad went right to sleep. Agendas. For so many single adults, the agenda is very, very simple. Thank you. That is what? To get married. Or, for the divorced or widowed, to get married again. I was out in Colorado speaking, and a woman came up and said, "Well, young man, you did a very good job." And I said, "Well, thank you." She said, I said to her, "I'll see you next year." She said, "You won't see me?" She said, "If I can't find a man in a year, you think I'm going to show my face around here?" And some single adults look on singleness as like a hunting season, you know? And as you only get to bag one, but be sure you bring him down on the first shot, you know, that sort of thing. Because a wounded one is dangerous to have in the neighborhood. It is more than an "I do." I want to take a second and talk to you about some of the myths we have. And here's the big one. You've heard it. "Some enchanted evening, boo-boo-boo, you may see a stranger across a crowded Bible study, and somehow you'll know." Have you ever had that feeling? I think some people go to Bible studies thinking, perhaps this might be the one. Did any of you have anyone suggest, "Well, maybe Prince Charming will be at the singles conference this week, and that's worth half the registration alone," you know, that sort of thing. People have this idea, that's why I'm going to meet someone. I want to take a second and ask a real stupid question. Why do people marry? You ever think about that? There's some very good reasons. Here you see the old shotgun approach. Number one is to legitimize sexual relations. I see a lot of people that who have been premaritally or non-maritally sexually involved, and because of the guilt, they decided we ought to get married. And my friends, that's not a reason to get married, because you've had premarital sexual, non-marital sexual contact. That's a grounds for forgiveness, not necessarily for marriage. And a lot of people have gotten married and the marriage never had a chance because of that. Number two, to get away from bad home environments. Thank God this one has been significantly reduced. But 20 years ago, a woman went from a bedroom in her father's house to a bedroom in her husband's house. And consequently, a lot of women never had any conceptualization, or men in some cases, of how to live alone. And now that so many more women are going to college, living in dormitories, living in apartments, getting out and living on their own, I think it has helped reduce this one significantly. Number three, everyone's getting married. I remember asking my wife, "Jane, if you didn't love me, why did you marry me?" And she said everyone was getting married that summer. And it was a stupid reason to marry me. I wish I had known that, but I didn't know, see. This idea, and it happens, the other day I got a phone call. Brother Smith, when can you get down to our church? And I said, "Well, what's wrong?" There's something wrong in the singles group. I said, "What's wrong?" Everybody's getting married. My president's married, my secretary, the treasurer's married, the vice president, the social secretary's married, the religious secretary. If it keeps up, there won't be anybody left in my singles group. Get down here and get it put out. One pastor said, "It must be in the drinking fountain. That's the only thing I can figure that's the lowest common denominator." And have you known some people when their friends are starting to get married, guess what? They punch an engagement from low or simmer to high boil. Have you ever kind of noticed how people do that and kind of hurry things up? Number four, for personal security. There are people who want someone to take control of them, and they want security. A death of a parent or a death of a friend may prompt that kind of, "I need somebody to take care of me," emotional kind of thing. The next one is to escalate a stagnant relationship. you've rocked along with Bozo for 9 years, you know. And you finally say, Bozo, either we're going to get married or we're going to break up. And he said, well, what's wrong with the way things are? I kind of like that. Well, yeah, Bozo does, you know. And you rock it. And sometimes people threaten and you force it. Well, I guess we'll get married. And it leads to a relationship that isn't going to have a chance to make it. This last statement I think is so important. I want you to hear it. Some weddings may be more emotionally shotgun than biologically shotgun. The emotional factor. What is it that some women are beginning to feel very strongly now? The biological time clock. Tick, 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 tick. And you have an idea. You know, it's coming around and the meter is running out and the alarm's going to go off. I dated a woman with a biological time clock. And you know what? I don't think she loved me. But she wanted marriage so that I could father a child. And once I understood that's where her real commitment was to a child more than to me, I mean, it was time for me to head for the exit sign. One of my friends talked about, though, he didn't discover that until it was too late. And he said it was such a tragic feeling that this sense of, I've got to have a man, I'm 35, and the time is running out, I've got to get married. And when you get into a panic situation, my friends, the likelihood of making a good decision in panic is very small. Remember that. I want to read to you the new wedding vows. Maybe you've heard these. They're outrageous. But it goes, wilt thou, John, have this woman to be thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy state of matrimony? Wilt thou comfort and keep her in sickness and in health? Wilt thou provide her with credit cards and a 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath house with central air conditioning, professional decorating, a new BMW, 2 weeks of in the Bahamas every spring, and a week of skiing just after Christmas so that she might regain her composure after the holidays? Wilt thou paint the house every 2 years, clean the gutters each and every spring, and see to it that the lawn is cared for? Wilt thou try to remember the little things that mean so much, like flowers on her anniversary, kind words when she's had a rough day or a bad tennis match, and an occasional, honey, you look pretty today? Wilt thou be understanding when she's tired, headachy, or upset about something, when she is pregnant, when she feels ugly, or when she has a big pimple on her chin? Wilt thou come home from work on time, or at least call when thou art going to be late? Wilt thou caulk the windows in the kids' room, clean out the attic, adjust the TV roof antenna, fix the faucet in the kitchen, throw all those old shirts in your closet, call the vet, go to the drugstore and pick up the prescriptions, run the bath water for her while you're upstairs, zip up her dress, carry in the groceries, and help with the 2 a.m. feeding? Wilt thou not watch football all weekend and during holidays? Wilt thou not be such a pig when thou dost shower and shave? Wilt thou shower and shave occasionally? Wilt thou listen patiently to long and boring stories about kids' codes, friends' cancerous aunts, girlfriends' husbands' misdeeds, infections, schools, houses, furniture, drapes, kitchen tile, clothes, shoes, makeup, hair, sore feet, and decorator cover checkbooks? Well, wilt thou, Jane, have this man to be thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy state of matrimony? Wilt thou honor him, comfort and keep him in sickness and in health? Wilt thou do all the dirtier things around the house, like clean out the bathrooms, change the diapers, empty the kitty litter, scoop up after the dog, clean the oven and under the kitchen sink? Wilt thou balance the checkbook and pay the bills? Wilt thou pick out the carpeting, drapes, wallpaper, sheets, bedspreads, kids' clothes, appliances, and Christmas cards? Wilt thou do the shopping, drop off the shirts to the laundry and remember to pick them up, refrain from cleaning out his drawers and organizing his wallet? Wilt thou try not to get too fat after the first child, do chest exercise to keep your breasts from sagging, pay attention to other parts of your body so that it may not get truly gross? Wilt thou have some patience on occasions when he's less than perfect? Wilt thou not nag or pester or ask stupid questions or accuse him of misconduct when he comes home late? Wilt thou not call him at the office and ask stupid things like, do you love me and what do you want for dinner? Wilt thou put up with his loud and rude friends, make him sandwiches late at night, remember his mother's birthday, admire his muscles, laugh at his jokes? Wilt thou wear your clothes for 2 or 3 seasons, go easy on his money, avoid using his razor on your legs, keep all your facial junk off the sink, and give him the good side of the bed? For as much as John and Jane have consented together in holy wedlock, and have witnessed the same before God and this company, by the joining of hands and the giving of rings, I pronounce their husband and wife in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You may now kiss the bride, but don't mess up her face or her hair because she has to have her picture taken. The new wedding vows. I want to focus on engagement, of asking the right questions. And for some people, engagement can be a very fearsome moment. Here they are. Look at old Bosco here. Look at that. Then you see the quivering right there in his boots. And here's the test. When a couple has chosen each other in calmer moments, and I'll let you define calmer, has known love and companionship, if they're devout Christians, if they're conscious of God's guidance in their lives which have brought them to this point, then we need to rejoice with them. But we have made weddings into these three-ring extravaganzas that, I mean, would scare anybody. And I think a lot of people have pre-ceremonial jitters because of all the responsibilities, and it's not necessarily pre-marital jitters, but they get very, very uptight. Here's a good, well, I want to come back to that one. Let me skip just a second. I want us to take a look at something about the whole seasons of engagement. Number one, the stages. The first stage is self-centered. In the self-centered stage, the couple is so self-centered, the couple is asking, how can this relationship serve me? And if you've already gotten engaged and you're still in that status, that's a dangerous point to be in. The second one is when you negotiate the quid pro quos, which the couple exchanges services. In essence, saying, scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And unfortunately, that gets carried into marriage a great deal. You give so much, and then I ante up. That kind of concept. The third stage is appreciate, accommodate. The couple accommodates each other's individualities. Okay, I know that he's going to spend half the fall hunting squirrels, or whatever you hunt here in the fall, you know. Or, he's going to be crazy every Saturday afternoon for football, and every Sunday afternoon, and every Monday night. So we'll date Tuesday through Friday, unless he's into high school football too. You know, it's Tuesday through Thursday. And you just know that's the way he is. I mean, any kind of ball goes through the air, he's chasing it. You know, that sort of thing, that's a dangerous sign. Another one is the couple compromises for the good of the engagement. Well, at least he's chasing a ball and not a woman. So I can live with that. As long as it's a football or basketball or baseball, I can deal with it. Then there's what we call the evolving relationship. The couple formulates habits of relating in order to deal with or avoid problems. That's the danger signal, in which you're afraid to say something. Why? The way they're going to react. And these are the four basic stages in the engagement. Now, let me give you some reasons why you ought to get good premarital counseling before you say I do. Number one, in this culture, we know more about getting married than we know about being married. All you have to go down to the Dalton or Walden's, and there's the Amy Vanderbilt's guide, and that sort of thing. Or you can hire a bridal consultant, will answer all your questions and orchestrate the whole thing, and you're in business. And if you haven't read the book, The Eternal Bliss Machine, you ought to read it. This woman went to 10,000 weddings, and she was a society editor for a paper, and her job was to write up weddings. The book is just a hoot. You think you want something original in a wedding, she has seen it all, you know, the whole kind of thing. Number two, God expects our decisions to be orderly. The steps of a righteous man, of a righteous woman, are ordered of the Lord. God wants us to make good decisions, and that means have good data to make good decisions with. Number three, premarital counseling is an investment. You don't want to go through divorce. As a person who's been through a divorce, I never want another one. I learned, boy, hard. I'd never recommend someone, you know, kind of bored. Hey, go get a divorce. You'll have a wonderful time. I have never recommended to anybody one of those kind of things. I mean, it's kind of like, do you want a heart attack or you want a divorce? I'll take the heart attack. I think it's that kind of thing, see? But it is a good investment in you. There are evil people in the world. And I want to say, let me go one more step. There are evil people in the church. I'm talking about a psychiatric, psychological classification of evil. They look nice. They know how to quote scripture. And they know how to pray. They know how to tell you all the jargon. They know the right words. You marry them, and it's as different as day and night. When you say, I do, you're going to be going, I did. It's that kind of thing. And you need to be extremely wise. And counseling is a way of getting to work through some of those things. You won't solve everything in premarital counseling, but it may be that that counseling will solve you a major crisis in your particular life. Let me go one more step. Some of you have very good incomes. You have bought a condominium, or you own a house, or you own some property. And let me tell you, because you own those things, you've become kind of a target for some people. I have not forgotten a woman I met whose thing was, liquidating assets of men. That was her favorite thing to do. It was her pastime. And I'm serious. She married them, you know, and she liquidated their assets as quickly as she could. I remember one of my friends that was married to her. He had a heart attack, open heart surgery. She went through and stripped the house of everything. He came home to a mattress. That was the only thing left in the house. There weren't even sheets when he came home from the hospital. And come to find out, he was the third man she had laundered like that. And I want to tell you, there are people like that in this world. And if you're making some money, they're going to say, hey, this is a good target. And they may love your bank account about half step more than they love you. Next one is, romance is a fog or an anesthetic. Sometimes I wish, if God ever gives me a lot of money, my ship comes in, I'm not at the airport when it comes in, and then I'm there at the dock. I want to start a place where they can lock singles up for 30 days and get it out of their system. You know, like cold turkey, make them sweat it out, you know. I think they'd rise up and call me blessed 30 days later, you know. I think, thank you, thank you, thank you. But you know, have you ever seen somebody that's in love in this kind of... Yeah. I had a roommate in love, and it was awful. I mean, it's disgusting. It was like, I mean, just gross the way it was, you know. Kind of like puppies, you know, kind of all over each other. It was just gross. You know? But there was romance, and it was so thick, you know, and I hated to kind of pop the bubble, you know. And have you ever seen somebody blowing a bubble, you know, and they get, watch this one, and they blow it big, and finally it pops. It's all over their hair. They're pulling it off their ears, you know, that sort of thing. That romance is that same kind of thing. You cannot build a relationship on romance. I'm telling you, that's the thing that bothers me about these romance novels. I was in a bookstore yesterday, it shall remain nameless, but half the wall was covered by these racy, you know, romance novels. And you read those things, and it's good for some women's heart. It gets a rhythm going that's good for their heart. But the problem is they want all the men they're going to date to look like some of the men that are on the covers of those things. And there aren't very many of those guys, and some of those are gay. So, you know, it's that kind of thing, reality. And if you're reading that romance novel and, you know, your heart is just a-pounding, the guy in singles group may not hardly be able to get along and just, like, you know, pound every once in a while, see? And you lock into those physical attributes, and that bothers me. Because suppose you're going to marry this big strapping jock. I mean, he's got muscles and everything, and he gets multiple sclerosis. So suddenly he doesn't have Mr. Mucho muscles anymore. What about your love? What happens then? Men that have fascinating women's breath, and there are men that are very, very attracted to that. It's a reality. What happens with a mastectomy? What happens with a hysterectomy? If you marry with those kind of things strongly focused, and there are people that do, the potential is that it may be removed, and then what's going to happen to the relationship if there is nothing there? The next one is, there are icebergs to avoid. You know, it's not the 10% of the iceberg above the waterline that sinks the ship. It's the 90% you can't see. Now, that's why I tell people in premarital counseling, go. Premarital counseling will at least warn you, hey, I think you need to know there are some icebergs out there you're going to have to, you know, avoid. They may not be able to get all of them solved, but at least you're aware. And you have that additional person who is committed to you helping you discover those. The next one is to protect the collective witness of the church. It's always a tragedy when I go back to a singles group and I see somebody I thought you got married. And I see their head go down and then I realize I've said the wrong thing. And they've been in one of those revolving door relationships. And some of them don't take very long, you know, to realize I made a great mistake, a really kind of mistake. Then what about that? What's the collective witness of the singles group? It's just a place to meet someone. You know, it's a meat market. And there are some single adult groups that are very little different than the bars. The only difference is they don't serve alcohol in the church. That's the only significant difference I see. And it's to protect the collective witness. I do not think a single adult group is a place to meet someone to marry. I know that happens. But I don't think that ever ought to be a top priority. It is a haven. It is a sanctuary from a rough, cruel world out there where you can come and be accepted of yourself without people trying to make mucho macho moves on you or to, you know, notch their belt. The next one is premarital, avoid the mistakes of others. And that makes enough sense. Premarital counseling paves the way for marital care. One of the things you'll need is good marital counseling. And the problem is there are some men who feel like, I don't need marital counseling. You know, I don't need to go to some shrink. A psychiatrist is not a shrink. A psychiatrist is a stretch. Now think about that. We have so misnamed psychiatrists and psychologists. They're not shrinks. I've never met one who's a shrink. They're stretchers. They always cause you to grow. And today I want to tell you something. It is just as natural and normal for you as a single adult to go for counseling as it is to have a dentist. I go for counseling regularly. Why? I don't have someone in my life to mirror me. There are times people need to talk to me. I need somebody to hold up the mirror and say, hey, Harold, here's a couple areas in your life you need to work on. I need a counselor. I don't feel bad if I go have my teeth worked on. I don't feel badly if I go to the doctor. Why should I feel badly if I happen to go for counseling? Don't ever be ashamed of going for counseling. It's a basic part of being good to yourself. The next one is, Premarital counseling helps the minister fulfill his vows. A minister is accountable to you, he's accountable to his congregation, and he's accountable to God. Okay, let's take a second and look at what engagement is. Number one, engagement is an opportunity to see the fiancé in everyday situations over a period of time. The more data you have, the more likely you are to make good decisions. Some of you are in business, and you don't make good decisions with a lack of data. You just don't do that. And I'm amazed. Some people tell me about huge, huge pieces of data. Now they're telling me to put a new McDonald's anywhere in this country takes a minimum of 200,000 pages of data. 200,000 pages of data before they'll build a McDonald's now anywhere in this country. And there's now a computer that's been developed and a computer systems company that will do that for a person that wants a McDonald's franchise. It tells them everything, you know, from the average amount of rainfall in that particular corner to the number of cars that have passed that corner for the last 15 years. Why? If they're going to put a McDonald's there, they want to have good data on that particular thing. It's the same thing in your life. You need good data. You need to see that fiancé in everyday life and not just a few occasions that you see him. Number two, to become better acquainted with the fiancé's family. Let me show you this, because remember, they come with a mama. And if you're going to marry a guy, mama's had a head start, you know. And remember what the wedding vow says? The wedding vow says this, forsaking all others. Now, we have traditionally meant that to say forsaking all other women. Or in the case of men, forsaking, well, I'm confused. For men forsaking all the women, for women forsaking all the men. That's what we meant. That's not what it says. It says forsaking all others. Mama is included in the others. Three times in Scripture it says, for this cause shall a man leave father or mother, shall cleave to his wife. Three times. My dad told me something three times. I was smart enough to know I better listen up, because he was meaning it. And I think that's what God is trying to say. And some people have never had a chance in their marriage. You know why? Mama had a stranglehold on their husband, and you won't win that. Take a look at this. You need to be thinking about this as you date. Here are three models of in-law relationships. Number one, in which us means we're going to be closer to my parents. Now, that's not just geographic distance. They live in Greenville, and we live in Greenville. But it also means economically or spiritually, emotionally, we're going to be closer to them. Model two means that we're right there in the center. We're halfway between both of them. But the third model is we're going to be closer to my fiancé's parents. Now, that'll happen in a relationship. It's very difficult to keep in mind. Your first Christmas is going to be the perfect time to discuss it. Are we going to your folks or are we going to my folks? Well, it wouldn't be Christmas if I'm not there. How many people fuss and feud over Christmas? Got to drive 561 miles to go up there for Christmas. I don't want to go. You know, but what? They got to go, you know? And then they fuss all the way up there, fuss 500. Didn't I tell you it was going to be this way? It's this way every year up there, you know? And some people nearly come to blows at Christmas time. And what happens if you tell both of them we're not coming to either one? Then you got both sets of parents mad, see? Or what about anybody got an Italian background where you go to mama's for Sunday dinner? Everybody goes to mama's. You know, and you decide you don't want to go to mama's and sit around eating, you know, pasta all afternoon, you know. But guess what? What kind of daughter-in-law is it doesn't want to come over and eat pasta at mama's, you know? And it's amazing how those things lock in. And now is the time to be looking closely at that family. Let me take a step further and talk about that family. How do they treat women in that family? If a woman offers an opinion, do the men say, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard? Do they put down women? Because let me tell you, if he has grown up with that model, guess what he's going to do? He's going to put women down. If he comes from an abusive family where it's verbal abuse, emotional, or physical, the likelihood is he's going to follow that pattern. That's just the reality, my friends. You need to be looking very carefully. A man will either react or respond to his mother. Now, let me say one last thing. Everything may be fine now, but suppose daddy-in-law dies. Mama wants to come and live with you. Or suddenly, mama begins putting emotional investments on her son. And suddenly mama is a problem. See, and that's where some people have problems. Everything's fine right now. And oh, I love my in-laws, but then suddenly there's a change. Let me go one more step and just talk to you very candidly. Some senior adults are on so much drugs. and especially things for high blood pressure, heart, the kidney medicines, and some of the mental, the depression medicines, you get those mixed in them, and they can get things so screwed up in their mentally, they'll be dreaming things, they get paranoid, and a mother-in-law that you have loved will drive you crazy in her senior years. And I'm talking about, I'm dealing with that in my family. It's just a reality, and it drives you absolutely insane. But it's part of that reality of looking very closely at that family. Number three, to create an amorous monogamy in which old flames and rivals are eliminated. Suppose you're sitting there fixing your nice little dinner, your newlyweds, and you get the phone call. Is Roger there? And you're pretty sure it's not Amway calling, you know? Just who is this calling on this phone? Tell him Becky called. Becky who? Oh, he'll know. I mean, let him come through the back door and watch what's going to happen. A little low-yield nuclear. Just who is this Becky and why is she calling? And then he gets this funny look on his face. You know, like, Becky? Becky? You better make sure, huh? Okay, you hear what I'm talking about? Those old flames are kind of nipped in the bud. Because some of them have a way of showing up. And sometimes Mama, you know, would have preferred him to marry Becky. And so every time you go home, halfway through dinner, you go, guess who I saw at J.C. Penney's the other day? Becky. Oh, let me tell you, Becky, she looks so good these days. Woo! Lord, child, does she look good. And you're sitting there, and I mean, the lid is just rattling on that, just, you know. And some in-laws like to do stuff like that, you know, so you got to deal with that. Number four, for insight into each other's responsiveness. When you ring the fire bell, the fire truck comes out, you know. But now some fires are one alarmers, there are some two alarmers, there are some where they bring everything, including the Coke machine, with them to the side of the fire. They're going to be there a while. And you need to see how people respond. Now, some people, have you ever met cool people? I mean, they don't get upset. I mean, you can wreck their car. And that's how I met my wife. She wrecked the last guy she was dating, brand new car, and he said, get lost, you know. Well, I felt that was a little harsh, you know, because a woman totals your brand new car, you tell her to get lost. So I just tried to cheer up a little bit, you know. And, that's enough said about that. But you need to check responsiveness. See what I'm saying? How people respond. And people got to be predictable. What happens when somebody is unpredictable? Don't tell him, there's no telling what he'll do if he finds out about it. You need to be able to guess people's responsiveness and to have seen it, see, like in this number one, over everyday situations. Next one is, let me give one of a specific. You know, some men are fine as long as they're healthy and you're healthy. But some men, are not cut out to be compassionate, you know. If you're sick, it's, what's wrong with you, you know, that's the thing. Or some men, if they get sick, they remember their mother, you know, spoon-feeding in chicken noodle soup, you know. Come on, Snookums, eat another bowl. It's going to be good for you. And they expect you to do that. And you're going, hey, I'm no RN, you know, you're a big boy, get over this. And some men, they get ill, it's, help us, you know. So that responsive in special situations. Discuss the realities of marriage, especially money, parenthood, and responsibilities. You know, these are tough days. I talked about with some people yesterday at lunch. I just came back from California, which, you know, it's the wildest place I've ever lived. I mean, a shack out there is $141,000 at 14% interest. You know, you can't buy houses out there. Well, what pressure does that put on a couple that gets married, okay? And suppose the woman really wants a kid, but they know they can't, you know, to make the house payments, and then she ends up pregnant. What do they do? And then what if he gets the feeling of she pushed him on the pregnancy thing, and she purposely got pregnant, see? That whole situation, then how does he feel resentment toward that child, that whole kind of thing? You need to talk through those things of parenthood, the responsibilities of money, how money is going to be decided. What do you decide is flimsy money that you can throw away? I mean, some people, you know, are very used to, they have a certain percentage of their budget that they don't worry about. If they see something, they buy it. Other people are very locked in. I never will forget two of my couples. In my master's, my study at Vanderbilt, I studied 42 couples of how they dealt with it. I've never forgot one of my couples. They were priceless. He came from a family that believed, did not believe in credit. They had no credit cards. They even paid cash for the car. The only thing they ever bought on time was their house. The mother was expected to go buy groceries 2 weeks at a time. She could not go to 7-Elevens, Quick Trips, any of those kind of things, okay? A meal was a meat, a potato, a yellow vegetable, a green vegetable, a salad, and dessert, and a bread served at 6 o'clock, not 5:59, not 6:01 on the dot. And the wife did not work. Anything a man's where he left it, that was where she knew to pick it up, okay? He got married to a woman who came from a very equal family, which meant if you see it needs to be done, you do it. Everybody worked. Mother, father worked. Each of the kids worked. They sometimes decide where they're going to eat on the way home. One night is Burger Doodle. The next night, Colonel Sanders. The next night, you know, pan-fried lasagna or whatever it is. That sort of thing, see? They got married. Now, they believed, the girl's family believed, that the purpose of credit cards was to spend it. You keep it in circulation. And if you got your credit card too high, either get a new ceiling or go get another credit card and just keep it all going, see? That sort of thing. And they used the Visa bill to pay the American Express card, and it was kind of that kind of stuff. They got married. The honeymoon was wonderful because they, you know, it was wonderful. Well, it's because, you know, her family gave them, you know, the money to go. And so they came back and they moved into a nice little student apartment. So she went to buy groceries for the first time. So he was sitting there stretched out on the couch watching a football game. And he said, "Now, honey, hey, you know, it's hot out there. You better go get the ice cream. The ice cream is going to melt and the meat will spoil." She said, "No, this is all I got, one bag." He said, "You expect us to eat 2 weeks out of one bag?" She said, "No, this is for tonight. I'll worry about tomorrow. He said, "What are you talking about? You only go to the grocery once every 2 weeks. Everybody knows that." She said, "What are you talking about? I don't know what we're going to have tonight yet, you know, let alone 2 weeks. He said, "Then you need to sit down and plan a menu and plan your leftovers." And she said, "Huh? What are you talking about?" So sure enough, to pacify him, she did. She went back to the grocery store, bought gobs of groceries. I mean, you know, groceries everywhere. So, you know, they went on a day or two, and she said, "Honey, you know, the garbage needs to be carried out." He said, "You know, I've been noticing that. It really stinks. It needs to be carried out." She said, "Well, you know, don't you carry it?" He said, "Let's look at it logically. You planned the menus, right? Yeah. You bought the food, right? Yeah. You cooked the food, right? Yeah. You served the food, yeah. And you cleaned up, right? Yeah. Well, your job is not through till you carry the garbage to the dumpster." She said, "You know, I never thought of it that way, you know." And he said, "Well, I just wanted you to understand." Well, he also believed wherever he dropped it was where she ought to pick it up, where it was a wet towel, his shorts, you know, whatever. Well, some way, and I'm not sure, they wouldn't tell me exactly how his shorts got on the coffee table, but they were there. And the minister that had married them always comes by to see couples, you know, about a week, 2 weeks later. Sure enough, and she had decided those shorts were going to stay there until someplace froze over. She wasn't moving, you know. So they all sit down, and suddenly all the eyes rivet on the pair of shorts on the coffee table. So he was embarrassed. "Oh, just doing some dusting. I'll talk to you after he's gone." Then after the pastor's gone, he said, "How do you think I felt with that underwear on the coffee table?" And she said, "They weren't mine." Well, he hit her upside the head, and after that, anytime she said anything dumb, he slapped her. And some of us began saying, "You know, we've never met a girl quite like this. She is so, get married, and the most clumsy thing, she always had a bruise or a scratch." To this day, he has never apologized, has beaten the daylights out of her at times. But his thing is, when she does something stupid, that's the way he responds. You see, it's this cross between these families, financial burdens, and that sort of thing, and to test the roles of husband and wife. He would tell you that's what a man's supposed to do, that I'm doing the role he saw from his father. And see, she saw a totally different role, and these create incredible amounts of friction. The last thing is stabilize the relationship, and then number 9 is what? To plan the wedding. We get it all reversed. I mean, we've got the Amy Vanderbilt, the modern brides, and all those as number 1. But my friends, that's the last part of the agenda. You've been sitting a while, I want everybody to stand, everybody up. A pair of shoulders, just reach over the pew and have a little laying on of the hand. I don't know why you have to laugh when you do this. All right, now turn forward. It's more blessed to receive than to give. All right, I want you to turn to the person on your right. No, wait a minute. This didn't work out. Hold on. Everybody, wait a minute. Turn to one person. That's what they were supposed to do. I'm sorry, I did the wrong thing. Find one person to turn to. And now here's what I want you to say. How about let's us go into lunch? Not yet, though. Okay, not yet. Some of you are already ready, moving for Burger King. Okay, have a seat. And I want to finish this, and then we'll go to lunch. You know?
Let me say one quick word. This is in parentheses. You know how you use parentheses? Please be friendly about, you know, seeing somebody and going to lunch. Because I'm very aware that sometimes people come. This is the first time they've been to Edwards Road. For some people here, this is probably the first singles conference they've ever been to. And this is all a little threatening to them. And it's very easy for us to kind of get with our clique, everybody we know, get in our cars and go race somewhere. But please kind of look around and say, do you have lunch plans? Why don't you come and go with us? We're going someplace. It just makes the conference a little bit better. Some of us, you know, are a little on the shy side, and they'll enjoy lunch, and you'll get to enjoy them and talking to them, and it'll make the day a little bit better memory for them. And who knows, it may be Prince Charming. I mean, you just may, where'd you meet? Oh, we met at Edwards Road over at Burger King. I mean, she was romping down, you know, it was wonderful, you know, kind of thing. God works in mysterious ways, His wonders to perform. Okay, why an engagement should be broken. Now, we don't like to talk about broken engagements. But my friends, that's a reality. There are some engagements that should never have been made. And really, they're doing you a favor. And 20 years from now, you will rise up and call them blessed, you know, because they did it. Now I want to say that I learned that broken engagements hurt. They really do. I thought that only those of us that had been through divorce knew pain until I went through a broken engagement after a divorce. And it hurts awful. I mean, there's just no easy way. The suit I have on today, I bought when the day Kathy got married. I was very depressed, and I was, so I thought, this is crazy. And, you know, where's the nearest clothing store? I walked in, and I said, I don't care what it is, just put it on me, and I'll pay you. Here's my credit card. And so that's what they put on me. But there are times when an engagement should be broken. And let's look at some steps, reasons. Number one, recognition of fundamental feelings of alienation. Now, I'm not just talking about a few doubts, okay, because the responsibilities of marriage are so great, it's scary, okay? But I'm talking about there's a sense, you feel it. You're not quite sure. You've tried to talk it out, but you're not quite sure what it is, a feeling of alienation. Number two, recognitions of strong misgivings about compatibility. You just have this feeling. And you know what we say? I can change him. I can change your foolish words. Huh? If you like that, I've got land I want to sell you down in South Florida. You'll love it. Number three, recognition that the engagement was made under pressure from relatives or circumstances. What I call is PTR, primetime relationships. It starts at Thanksgiving, goes to Valentine's Day. Nobody wants to eat turkey by themselves on Thanksgiving, you know? And then you get to thinking, oh my Lord, Christmas is coming, and I'm going to be, oh no, no. And so guess what we do? And then there's this idea of a ring for Christmas, the ultimate gift. So what you do is press the little simmer button and press the hot button in instant relationship, you know? And some people like that. They form a relationship during the Christmas season. And Bozo goes out the front door the 1st of January with the dead Christmas tree, you know? And it'd be real nice. He'll carry the Christmas tree as he makes his exit, see? And then comes Valentine's Day. Oh, no, no, you know? No Valentine card, no flowers, no all that kind of stuff. And it's very easy to get this thing rolling. It's like a snowball coming down the hill, and it's going, it's going. And guess what? You're going to end up engaged. Third is recognition. No, that's done that. Four, recognition that the main reason for continuing engagement is fear of embarrassment. There used to be a thing in this country called breach of contract. Thank God it is no longer in effect in this country. But that means this: if you were ever once engaged and the engagement was broken, you could never marry. James Buchanan, the only man, bachelor, ever to be president of the United States, 15th president of the United States, was engaged. His girlfriend, fiance, broke the engagement and died 10 days later. And out of honor to her, he never, ever married. Same thing is true of Catherine Beecher. Some of you know about the whole thing she did. Her fiancé, Professor Fisher from Harvard, was killed in a shipwreck, and she never married again. Never married. It was a thing of honor to his memory. And so she gave us physical education in public schools. She gave us guidance counselors. And she was the one that lobbied for women to be school teachers. An incredible woman. So we got great gifts from those two people. But it was just understood that if you broke the engagement, there could even be a suit to recover damages. That was particularly true here in the South. The next one is recognition that the fiancé is too immature to marry. That one of these situations, remember I talked about life situations or responses, you suddenly go, this person's immature. That the person is too immature. The next one is that the recognition of changes in economics, a serious illness or an accident, an unemployment. A woman came up to me and wanted to know if she thought I ought to marry some guy. He hadn't been worked in a year, and they were kind of, you know, living on her money if they went on a date, and he thought they ought to get married. And I said, fool. You know, you are a dummy. That's what you are. You are a dummy. You know? Next one is recognition that the marriage is not in God's will. It is so easy. Let me just be gutsy with you to talk God talk.
it's so easy. God's will and God led us together. You know, there's a thing called blasphemy. And some things God didn't have anything to do with. He was in Jamaica on vacation when it happened. You know? And it's very easy. God has drawn us together. Don't you dare accuse God of that. God would never so mismatch people. But people get into that whole God talk. And suddenly it's very difficult because why? There's something mysterious out of, you know, the 8,256,000 surplus, God chose me, and, you know, that whole idea. But see, a lot of times it's us. You know, I talk to people after the marriage, and sometimes they're not quite as anxious to say God brought us together afterwards as they are during an engagement. Okay, let's look at guidelines to break a decision. Number one, distinguish between premarital and pre-ceremonial jitters. See, your first option is number two. It's strange. Number two is first. I don't know how that happened. First, consider postponing the wedding. That's always your first option. Just say, you know, we need time. And I've seen that work so well. I just sent a wedding present this week to somebody who broke an engagement. It was horrible. I mean, the tears, the lashing, the ashes, the sackcloth, the whole thing. But he needed time. He's a brilliant, brilliant musician. And he just wasn't quite ready. And it was a very small college campus, and everybody knew, and all that sort of thing. But last, 2 weeks ago today, they got married. Because he had come to the point of really realizing how much he loved her. Now, you know, one person could say, well, you could have already been married and everything would have worked out. I'm not so sure. But it was a great wedding. I was kind of tickled by it because they gave it time. And I think the relationship is going to be stronger. Number three, don't threaten or manipulate. Either you get your act together or you can have your ring back. Because see, they may get their act together, but that's not the life-term consequences. It's still going to be a bad consequence. That's not what you need. So don't threaten or manipulate. Don't be intimidated or manipulated by threats. I'm going to jump off the Empire State Building if you don't marry me. Be my guest. Tell me what time to be there. I'll bring my crowd. We'll sell the movie rights. You know, some people threaten. I mean, you know, that's crazy. I remember in college, this woman was going to jump off the bell tower. It was only 9 feet, you know. We were going, jump, jump, you know. Face first, preferably. Jump, you know, right into this thing. Next one is reject the relationship, not the person. And that's true in dating. Somebody wants to date you, you don't want to date them. You're rejecting the relationship, not the person. That's the neat thing Kathy did to me. She said, Harold, it's not that I don't care for you. I care for you deeply. But I'm rejecting the relationship. You're committed to your ministry, and I want all of you. I won't share you. And you know, I'm glad she said that. You know, we talked through it. Horrible. I mean, I cried, she cried. But today, we're very, very good friends. Why? She wasn't rejecting me. She was rejecting the relationship. Her understanding of what she wanted for a husband was something I could not fulfill. She wanted a husband who's going to be home every night for dinner, you know. And that's not me. I enjoy traveling. I enjoy working with single adults. So she rejected the relationship. And to this day, I'm grateful that she helped me because, number six, she communicated. She talked to me and she said, I need to talk to you. This isn't going to be pleasant, but I need to talk. And she just opened up and she shared. And, you know, she didn't use that you talk. But she, you know, openly talked about, now see, you made this decision and this is how I felt. And I admit some of those I felt, oh gosh, I didn't think about that. But it helped me understand and correct some of those things because she was not rejecting me, she was rejecting the relationship, but she thought through it enough to communicate. The next one is be honest. Be real honest. You know, that helped me that Kathy said to me, you know, you're committed to this ministry thing so much. See, that helped me. I mean, if she just kind of beat around the bush, well, you know, that wouldn't have helped me. But it helped me understand specifically because she was honest. The next one is don't prolong the decision. It's never going to be easier. You know, it isn't going to be easier. When you know the decision needs to be made, that's the time to make the decision. Allow your grief. I really hurt when Kathy made that decision. She made the decision, unfortunately, the day after Thanksgiving. And there, I'd already bought her presents for Christmas. And Christmas was a total wipe. I thought the Christmas of my divorce was awful. But I have to admit, that Christmas was just a disaster. In a lot of ways, it was similar. See, it brought back a lot of memories. I had so looked forward to Christmas. And suddenly, there wasn't a Christmas to look forward to. But I allowed my grief. I didn't rush out and say, well, I'm going to find somebody to give these gifts to. I took the gifts back. See? And I allowed my mourning period to say, I hurt. And it's going to be a while before I'm ready to invest again in another relationship. And the next one is recognize your vulnerability. You see, there are a lot of emergency room specialists around. Oh, you poor thing. Let me just move right in on you and take care of you, and I'll have you back. And there are some women that are specialists in nursing rooms. I mean, the more blood and the more guts that are hanging out, I mean, they're great. You know, and they get the old boy back on his feet, and guess what? He's gone, forget you. And some women, by this point in their life, have been through 5 or 6 emergency room relationships. And that mutual need, deficiencies, my friend, is not what God wants. It just isn't. And there are men that are like that. Let me move in. I'm going to declare martial law, and we'll get all this straightened out. Your kids are out of control. I'll move in and get them straightened out, see? And you lock into those kind of relationships, and you got to recognize your vulnerability. Sure, it hurts. It's no fun. But it's part of saying, I'm healing, and things are going to get a little bit better. Let me cover a couple cartoons, because you haven't laughed in a while. It's gotten too serious. Here are 3 big problems you're going to have to face. Number 1 are wandering eyes. Let me move that one. I mean, if he is having a head crank, and you're driving away, you know, that's a bad problem. You know, that's kind of bad. Number 2 is confused roads. Just who's going to carry whom across that threshold? See? Number 3 is unrealistic expectations. You know, if you expect her to be a gourmet cook and about all she can do is reheat lasagna, you know, you're going to have problems with that. And then in-laws, you know, that total concept of in-laws, of dealing with it. And I just want to say one thing about submission. And, you know, I probably shouldn't say anything, but I want to say something about that. Our generation is really struggling with this because you can go into any Christian bookstore and they're going to tell you about submission. I mean, you know, that's the big buzz word, submission. But remember this, when Jesus talked about submission, he was not talking about a woman being ground into the dirt. I've just finished my first novel. It's called Priscilla and Aquila. And that's what the book is about, submission. And it was a tough book to write, but I wanted to say some things in fiction that I couldn't say in other ways. But I really believe this. I don't believe God calls any woman to be a doormat or a punching bag, to ever be put down or to suffer verbal abuse. I meet a lot of women, they have no bruises. They have no scars, no scabs. They're all right here. Deep in their heart, they've been put down so much, so often. And I just don't believe this. I believe there is a time, and here's what I believe in submission. As a writer, I have to submit to my editors. That's very important. I send them a manuscript, but because of the nature of the relationship is sometimes they say, Harold, the manuscript isn't good enough. You got to rewrite it, or we want you to change the following things. That's never any fun. But in the last book that had to have major rewrites, I am so tickled to have my name on it because it is such a good book. You know why? An editor would not submit to the pressure from me as an author and saying, well, I'll take it to somebody else and they'll publish it. And that happens a lot in the publishing world. But I chose to say this editor is committed to helping me. But the editor also said she knew that Harold was committing to make her look good by giving a bestseller to her, say, a good book. So that's what I'm talking about when I think of submission. It's setting aside some of my rights, but it's never manipulating that person or using that person as a doormat. And then I want to ask just a couple simple questions, and then we're going to be through, and it'll be lunchtime. Here are some questions I think you ought to be asking during the engagement period. Number 1, the fruit of the Spirit is love. Is there an increasing concern for each other in your engagement? You need to think about that. Number 2, the Spirit is joy. Is there an increasing season of gladness in your engagement? I've seen some sad brides, some unhappy brides, and it bothered me if something is wrong. Something is really wrong here. Number 3, the fruit of the Spirit is peace. Is there an increased quiet in your hearts, in your love? 4, the fruit of the Spirit is long-suffering. Is there an increasing stretch in your attitudes where you're more long-suffering? You're willing to give some rope, some maneuverability. Number 5, the fruit of the Spirit is gentleness. Are you increasingly kind, more courteous, softer in your touch? Number 6, the fruit of the Spirit is meekness. Is there a growing self-honesty in each of you? Number 7, the fruit of the Spirit is goodness. More and more do you seek to be a blessing. Number 8, the fruit of the Spirit is faith. Are your fears on the decline? The fruit of the Spirit is temperance. Number 9, are you more and more in charge of your emotions? And number 10, have you grown spiritually in this engagement? Let me just tell you, here's a good rule of thumb to ask yourself. in dating this person and engaging them. Have I grown closer to the Lord through dating, being engaged to this person, or have I grown further away from the Lord? I do not believe the Lord will bring someone into your life that's going to take you further from Him. But I believe the Lord will bring someone into your life who will bring you closer to Him. I do believe that. That's a tough question to really answer accurately. But it's a question that could make a difference in your relationship. And then one last thing I want to read. And that's a Christian marriage. A Christian marriage is a daily commitment that realizes that the vows made at a flower-lined altar are only as good as those made at the altars of everyday life. I say that for two reasons. Number one, it's great that you come to the altar of the church and you have the gladiolas and the carnations and the I love you truly and the five-tier wedding cake. Great. Great for you. But remember this. Those vows are only as good as the daily vows made. Okay? It's a daily proposition. Somebody asked Billy Graham, what would you do if you decided you weren't in love with Ruth? He thought a moment. He said, I'd get down on my knees and begin praying, and I wouldn't get up till either I loved Ruth or I could act toward Ruth in loving ways. And I thought that was a great statement. I would either try to love Ruth or I could act toward her in loving ways. It's a daily commitment. There are going to be times in a marriage when the sex is not good, when the romance is not good, when the feelings aren't strong. You don't feel like it. Some little cute little thing down at the office suddenly looks like ecstasy. And a lot of people chase after those kind of pipe dreams. But it's a commitment to say, I choose to act toward you in loving ways. The second thing I want to say is this. Some of you, like me, have been through this process of divorce. And somebody comes up and they'll say, bless God, I took my wedding vows seriously. And there's never an answer. I took my wedding vows seriously. But remember this. See, the vows that you took once are only as good as the daily vows. And what I have to understand is that Jane didn't keep up the vows and she chose to leave me. And that gives me hope to believe I can vow again. See, that I'm not locked because I failed in one set of vows, that I'm forever doomed to some kind of second-class living. And don't let anybody tell you that because you've been married once you're used. You're not used. No one is used in the presence of Christ. I dated a woman who had never been married, a foreign lady. It's interesting, when I met the family at Christmas, I was scared. And one of them said, isn't it a tragedy that God didn't bring an unused man into her life, that He had to bring a used man? And it destroyed the relationship because I began to understand the family thought behind and the strength of the total family was such. I didn't feel used then and I don't feel used now. Yeah, I'm divorced. But that doesn't make me any less than what I can ever be. Let me say one more thing too. I haven't seen any in this church yet, but maybe there's some somewhere. I love stained glass windows. I love them. I love them. In my church, where we grew up in, a little tiny church, we didn't have any money, and we wanted stained glass windows, and we found out how much they cost, and so then we decided we'd have one stained glass window, and we found out how much that would cost, so we decided to get colored sheets of glass from the hardware store and put in the windows. And I admit it was kind of pretty, you know, the sun was like a day like this, the sun was shining in, it was kind of pretty, and at night, if you were late for church, the electric light was shining in, it was kind of pretty. But we bought them on sale and we stored them in the basement of the church, and some of them got broken. And when they're broken, you can't just put electrician's duct tape on them. It doesn't look good at the church dedication, you know, it looks tacky. But the only thing you can do is throw it in the trash and go down to the hardware store and get a new piece of glass and put it in, see? But in stained glass, you can't make a stained glass window out of a whole sheet of glass. Did you know that? A stained glass window can only be made out of broken pieces of glass. And some of the most beautiful stained glass windows are the ones with the most shattered pieces of glass. You see, I can take the thing that a shattered piece of glass, I can put it right here in my hand, cling down, and guess what? It's going to start cutting into my hand. I'll bleed. But it's also possible for God to take that shattered piece of glass, put it in just the right place, and it becomes an incredible thing of beauty. And some of you are better equipped to say, I do the second time, than some of you are thinking about saying it the first time, because you fully understand all that marriage means. Don't ever think you're used. In Jesus Christ, there are no used people. Whole people are what really follow Him. You've been a great group. Let me just say this, and then I'm going to read a children's story and we're going to lunch. I have been sometimes accused of being against marriage. I'm not against marriage. Boy, I believe marriage is great. And you know, if it's for you, I want you to go for it. But I don't want you in a marriage that won't bring out all of your potential. I don't want you in a second-class marriage. I want you in a marriage married to someone that loves you, that makes a commitment to you, and wants to see the very best come out of you. And that person that will be with you no matter what happens. It's emotional for me to come back to Greenville. Very, very emotional. Because I remember the first time I drove out of Brevard the day Jane left me, crying, couldn't see the road as I drove down through these mountains. I remember the many times when I had been on road trips for the college, coming in, and just not, I couldn't face going back to that empty house on campus. I just couldn't face it. Many Friday nights I'd go to a mall right here, either in Greenville or in Spartanburg, just walk for hours, you know. And I believe God is a God who brings wholeness in our life, you know. And some of us have been hurt, but the good news of the gospel is God always brings us to our potential. And He's always leading us to the kind of potential He wants us to have. I think I want to read The Bear and the Crow. I think that's what I want to read. The bear was on his way to town. He was dressed in his finest coat and vest. He was wearing his best derby hat and his shiny shoes. "How grand I look," said the bear to himself. "The townsfolk will be impressed. My clothes are at the height of fashion." "Forgive me for listening," said a crow who was sitting on a branch of a tree, "but I must disagree. Your clothes are not at the height of fashion. I've just flown in from town. I can tell you exactly how the gentlemen are dressed." "Oh, do tell me," cried the bear. "I'm eager to wear the most proper attire." "This year," said the crow, "the gentlemen are not wearing hats. They all have frying pans on their heads. And they're not wearing coats and vests. They're covering themselves with bed sheets. They're not wearing shoes. They're putting paper bags on their feet." "Oh, dear," cried the bear. "My clothes are completely wrong." The bear hurried home. He took off his coat and vest and hat and shoes. He put a frying pan on his head. He wrapped himself in a bed sheet. He stuffed his feet into large paper bags and rushed off toward the town. When the bear arrived on Main Street, the people giggled and smirked and pointed their fingers. "What a ridiculous bear," they laughed. The embarrassed bear turned around and ran home. On the way home, he met the crow again. "Crow, you did not tell me the truth," cried the bear. "I told you many things," said the crow as he flew out of the tree, "but never once did I tell you that I was telling the truth." Even though the crow was high in the sky, the bear could still hear the sound of his crackling laughter. And what is the fable's moral? When the need is strong, there are those who will believe anything. Jesus, we thank you for this morning. These are such good people. Oh, you must be tickled with every one of them. But there is an enemy who would love to make a mess of their lives, in some cases make another mess of their lives. Father, don't let us, because we're desperate for somebody to love us and somebody to hold us and somebody to be close to us, don't let us be willing to just believe anything some crow tells us. But give us the courage to dare to believe that we can become all that you dreamed us to be. And if marriage is part of that dream, we'll be ready for it and we'll give ourselves in a great commitment to it. We ask in the name of your Son who was single. Amen.